My name's Marianne Williams. I'm a specialist gastroenterology dietitian, and welcome to the first in our clinical cases podcast series.
So I called Lou and she came in to see this kind of wreck on the bathroom floor. I just said to her, I said, this has got to stop. You know, this can't happen to me, not as a grown-up, you know.
But before we listen to this very interesting case study, just want to give you a little bit of a background as to why we have decided to set up this podcast series. Several years ago, in fact, almost exactly 10 years ago, an excellent textbook came out, which was called Clinical Cases. And even as a slow reader, I devoured that book in less than 24 hours. The cases covered real-life examples from over 70 patients, looking at conditions as diverse as head injury, liver disease, stroke patients, diabetes, they had ulcerative colitis, they had breast cancer, pancreatitis, and the list just went on. They were fantastic learning tools for myself as a healthcare professional. But technology's actually moved on in leaps and bounds since that book was published back in 2008. And with the advent of podcasts, it seemed a bit of a no-brainer, really, to set up a podcast series of clinical cases. I thought it would be fascinating to hear patients tell their own stories and their journey into finding a solution for their health issues. Each case will be a patient who has been treated by a healthcare professional and who has agreed to tell their story to help clinicians learn. In essence, I guess you'd say it's continuous professional development by podcast. I hope you enjoy this first episode, and this was a really particularly interesting case and perhaps a lesson on how to look beyond blood tests. And I guess my question to you would be, does this patient have celiac disease or not? Alan, thank you very much for joining me today.
That's all right.
What I'd like to do is take you right back to when you were a child, and what's your first memories of the symptoms you had? What were the symptoms you were getting?
Well, as a child, I went through various kind of reactions, and it was always my gut, you know. So I had, I was treated for severe constipation at one stage as a child. And also, my sister to this day thinks I was avoiding the washing up after Sunday dinner or whatever, because I'd have to go straight to the loo. My food always seemed to go straight through me.
And was that sort of pretty much the standard, not just obviously on Sundays, do you find most times when you had an evening meal, you were straight onto the loo?
Yeah.
Did you get pain and things like that
as well?
I
did. I tended to get a kind of stitch down my left-hand side. So I'd get a stitch in my left-hand side, I'd get gurgling in my tummy, you know, and it just, everything just felt quite liquid and fluid. And then I'd get to a point where I knew I'd have to run. And yeah, I couldn't walk to the loo, I'd run to the loo.
There was no holding it.
There was no holding it, and they just felt as if there was an awful lot of pressure.
And this was, what sort of age do you remember this being? Or how young were you, do you remember?
I suppose the constipation, I'm trying to remember the house that I lived in with my parents. So I remember being treated for constipation and having severe diarrhoea at different times. When I was 8, 9, 10, 11, that kind of age. And then 13, 14, 15, I remember the kind of the Sunday washing up issue being a little bit more prominent, and me feeling quite ill, you know, quite ill with my tummy. And again, I can remember being out for dinner with mum and dad as a family, you know, and feeling really ill afterwards. I remember lying on the sofa, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, having come back from a lovely day with the family, thinking, I feel really awful. But I actually just thought, everybody reacted to food that way. You know, you just think, well, maybe everyone's the same and they're just better at hiding it or better
when
at controlling
it. When you didn't
it.
Eat, were you not getting any of these symptoms? So if you just had a day when you didn't eat much, did you find you felt a lot better?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So by not eating or eating really simply, that seemed to be a little bit better. And different meals. You know, mum had a kind of a standard approach. You know, she had three kids and my dad worked really long hours, you know, when we were young, as happened back then. So, you know, we knew what we were having for dinner most days. We, you know, we'd have a roast on a Sunday and leftovers on a Monday. We'd have something else on a Tuesday and leftovers on a Wednesday. And, you know, so we knew what we were having. And I knew on a Wednesday, Mum used to make this meal, and she won't thank me for saying it, which was mince with rice. And that was okay.
Interesting. You knew on a Wednesday...
Wednesdays
not going to have to rush to the loo.
Probably Thursdays, because sometimes we'd have leftovers. And that was all right. you wouldn't make it nowadays. You know, the flavour wasn't great and that kind of thing. But mince and rice.
I hope she's not listening to this.
Yeah, fingers crossed. But I remember that meal particularly was one that I really enjoyed. And I suppose it was a bit of reverse thought process that I could enjoy a meal when I knew it wasn't going to impact on me too much.
Were there particular meals that you always associated with having a major problem at home?
Not off the top of my head, but I know that there were certain things in chicken, you know, roast chicken seems to... I just associate certain things with roast chicken, but, you know, we used to have Sunday lunch and Mum always made a magnificent kind of blackberry and apple crumble afterwards and we'd have that with ice cream. And quite often that might tip me over the edge, you know.
So the roast chicken may be a bit of a red herring in the sense that there was a lot of other things going on with that roast meal, including gravy, including the crumble.
So all of that stuff. And, you know, if we had ice cream with the crumble, all of that kind of just built this, it built up and I could feel it halfway through the dinner. I'd know what was going to happen, you know.
So quite quick.
Quite quick. Yeah.
So during the dinner, you're already feeling your stomach on the way. Yeah. So you were telling me before that as a teenager, your stools were really quite loose by this point. You were generally having Bristol stool scales sort of 6 to 7, which is the very end of the scale. So quite watery stools. Was that what you were having generally day to day?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. And then you went on into sort of early adulthood. And I gather your stools sort of got a bit better, but then you started having these bizarre sort of attacks.
I did get a bit better, I think, you know, and sometimes it's hard. I got comparatively better. So, you know, compared to what I was, I think things settled down for a while. Maybe it was the kind of diet I was having at the time. Maybe my diet was slightly healthier than it was when I was a teenager. I can't quite put my finger on it. But then I developed from the age, you know, from my early 20s, I suppose, I started having these attacks of what I always put down to being food poisoning.
Take me through one of these attacks. What were they like?
So a food poisoning attack would be come on quite slowly. So I'd end up having this sense of nausea. Mm-hmm. And this kind
how long would that go on for?
An hour or two hours. You know, the nausea would be there and there'd be an uncertainty as to whether I'd need to sit on the loo or stand over the loo.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't know which way the food was going to go,
up
or down. And I'd get a slight breathlessness because my body was deciding what to do. You know, and you know, you can almost feel the wall of your stomach ready to just push everything out. So I can remember on a few occasions when my older boys now were babies and my wife at the time when she was out, I had an attack one night and it came on really quite quickly and my whole dinner came up and then whatever I'd eaten during the day came
ouch.
Down. And really, really sick. I get a high temperature with it, quite shivery, quite cold. And I always put that down to food poisoning.
And were any of the other family coming down with the food poisoning?
Which was always quite baffling, you know.
So you'd be the only one?
Isolated. You
repeatedly.
Know,
and repeatedly. This would happen. How often was this happening?
I suppose to start with, maybe once or twice a year, and then it was up to 3, 4, 5 times a year.
Okay, so you got it every couple of months.
Yeah.
So what age were you by the time it was happening every couple of months?
I suppose I was early 40s.
Okay, and you were, I remember you saying you sort of almost in convulsions on the bathroom floor.
Yeah, that was the point at which I knew that I needed to do something. And, you know, it's never easy to talk about it, but I went to bed one night feeling fairly ill and then had an issue in bed without saying any more. Couldn't get out of bed quick enough.
Bless you.
And that was horrible, you know, it was it's a horrible thing to happen to an adult. So that was fine, you know, we dealt with that. Louise was with me at the time and she was amazing in kind of just supporting me and not making it as embarrassing as it could be. And then I made it to the bathroom. I vomited and had diarrhea pretty much at the same time, you know, so I was sitting on the loo and vomiting on my feet and then I was shaking with the cold and then I fell off the toilet onto the floor and I couldn't stand up. So I called Lou and she came in to see this kind of wreck on the bathroom floor. And I just said to her, I said, this has got to stop. You know, this can't, you know, I felt like a baby. I felt like a child, helpless child on the bathroom floor. And I just said to her, this needs to stop. this shouldn't be happening to me, not as a grown-up, you know, and without any help. So that was the point at which I needed to go to the doctor. I'd lost quite a bit of weight at that stage as well.
Mm. How much weight had you lost?
Well, I sit comfortably between 11 and 11 and a half stone. That's my kind of fighting weight, as you call it. Mm. And I was, by the time I went to the doctor, I think I was down to about 10 stone.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I'm not a big person. I was quite gaunt. And I remember people would ask you, how you are, you've lost a bit of weight, blah, blah, blah. And I say to people now, you know that you look terrible when people stop asking you how you are, because they presume that there's something chronic wrong. So people had stopped saying, how are you? I wasn't getting as much sleep as I'd like to, because I wasn't eating as much as I want. I wasn't exercising, so I didn't look
healthy. Were you feeling, by this point, were you feeling ill every day?
Yeah.
So now was not every 2 months. I mean, the big attacks were once every 2 months, but generally, day to day, what were you feeling like?
Life was cloudy. You know, it wasn't, it was just hard. Every day was hard. You know, it was waking up tired in the mornings and really struggling just to have the energy, the motivation to do things. And I used to do an awful lot of running. I used to do a lot of training. You know, I'm busy with the kids and I just didn't have the energy for it. Didn't have the enthusiasm. You know, Lou would say, should we go on holiday? Should we go out with the boys for the weekend? And I was like, oh, don't really want to, you know, like, can we just stay at home? I'm really tired. And so what I thought were simple symptoms were having a much wider impact on other people's lives than I realised. Mm. And I was just becoming a bit miserable.
So your quality of life was being majorly affected. And
not
family
just, for me, but for Louise and the kids as well, because I didn't have a spark at all. Mm. And my whole life was dominated around the toilet, you know, making sure that I could go. But it went beyond that, to be honest. It was quite depressing to be like that, you know. And I was skinny and cold and no energy, and that really upset me, because I'm generally full of energy and full of, like, passion for life, and I just didn't have it.
And I remember you saying the lack of energy was just as if you were walking through treacle. Yeah. It was so hard to actually get up and go
get
and do
up,
anything.
Get out, do anything. But also the mental side of it. You know, I just felt blunted. You know, you didn't have the sharp edge in meetings or when you're asked questions. Didn't have that ability to respond to things.
To foggy headedness?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the other symptoms you started to get, you mentioned that you started to get a really nasty rash.
Yeah. I got sores on my elbows. I'll never forget, you know, putting my elbows on a table and going, oh, that's sore.
Was it itchy as well?
It was quite itchy and to the point of bleeding. So my elbows, on my coccyx, surprisingly, that was the itchiest place. And I'd wake up at night scratching while I was asleep, bleeding from my coccyx because it was so itchy.
Yeah.
Elbows and slightly on the backs of my knees at times.
Yeah.
You know, that never got that bad on the backs of my knees, but my elbows were bad to the point I couldn't put them on the table. You know, to lean on the table, they'd get really sore. And the other symptom that was really restrictive for me was my hands. I got what I thought was arthritis developing. I've used chainsaws and climbed trees for years, and I don't do as much physical activity as I used to, work-wise, but I just thought, that's not on. So I went to the doctor and I said, I think I've got early onset of arthritis in my hands. Took a blood test and said, nothing wrong. That's a shame. Not a shame.
But I wanted some
kind of diagnosis. So there was nothing wrong after the bloods for the arthritis.
And you said you had back pain as well.
So I suffered a lot with lower back pain, which thankfully I don't have anymore.
And anxiety levels, you mentioned anxiety. Was that just because you're constantly moving from one place to the other, thinking, I need to be near a loo, I don't know what's going to happen from one minute to the next? Or was there a different type of level of anxiety going on?
I think it was partly that, and you end up developing a habit of feeling anxious because you don't know where to go. But also you withdraw from people a little bit because you can't commit to going out with friends. You can't commit to having a proper social life or things like that because you just feel awful. You know, you don't feel like doing things. And also, you don't want to, you don't want to go around to people's houses. I remember going to people's houses and, you know, having to use the loo in the middle of dinner or just after dinner. And that's kind of embarrassing as well. You know, I'm just going to nip to the gents and you're up there for 15 minutes. And that's kind of embarrassing. It developing a relationship with someone new in your life wasn't easy. You know, it put quite a restriction on my life, you know, developing a relationship with Louise and, you know, staying over at her house or her coming to stay at mine. You know, my flatulence, bad wind was terrible, you know, and it was just really hard to control. So you're just better off on your own.
And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand unless they've had those sort of gut symptoms. That level of wind.
I came up with coping mechanisms, you know, you leave the room, I go and put it on. Back in a minute. It goes up and down like a yo-yo. You know, we'd watch a film in 10 minute intervals, you know, because I'll be back in a minute. Can I get you anything from the kitchen, love? Can I do this? And, you know, don't go in the kitchen. So all of those things build up to kind of, and just talking about it now, it just builds up to it totally taking over your life and dominating everything. So I was really worried, you know, I thought my head was going down, like, all sorts of
And you'd lost
routes.
Weight and you were feeling so rubbish. And
you presume you have cancer in there somewhere.
Yeah, your appetite's not great. Yeah.
I went to see my GP after Lou picked me up off the bathroom floor. I said to her, that's enough. And then I spoke to my GP on the phone the next day. So he sent me for the VT colonoscopy to make sure that everything was okay and everything looked okay in there. And so that was where they pumped me full of gas, you know, that I drank that amazing fluid. And that was the first time, do you know, in ages that I felt okay.
That's interesting. So actually the prep they gave you to clear out your bowel
was amazing.
You felt the best you'd felt for ages.
Yeah, and I know, you know, they warn you when they send it to you through the post, so this stuff turns up on your doorstep and it says drink it, you will be on the loo for a day and it would clean your system out. And even sitting here talking to you now, I remember thinking, this feels great. You know, at least I know what's going to happen. And my system was clear. And after the procedure, they give you a couple of biscuits and a cup of tea. I didn't want to eat. I just thought, this is great, I feel really good. My stomach's empty, my bowel is empty. There's no threat of anything happening. And I knew the minute I put anything back into me, I'd be back into that cycle of wind and diarrhea and all of that again.
And the irony was they were giving you a biscuit.
Biscuits, yeah, but I didn't eat it. So after that, then my GP said, okay, those tests are okay. And I said it would be interesting to talk to a dietitian because it must be something to do with my diet. So he sent me to see a dietitian in Salisbury and she was really good. She put me on the white diet, which... from memory, is white rice, white bread.
So low fibre, basically.
Low fibre. That didn't really help. It didn't really help at all. It simplified my diet, which was quite good.
But you were still getting all the symptoms.
Yeah, still getting the symptoms. So I think that was a 3-month diet I was on, which, you know, was pasta heavy and bread heavy, and all the symptoms were there, and I wasn't getting much better. A couple of things did settle down. But not considerably.
So you were still getting very loose stools. You were still, you still got your rash. You still got the joint pains.
Yeah.
You still got your walking through treacle. You're still rushing to the loo.
Yeah, all of that stuff.
All
was
the
still
urgency
there.
Still there.
But okay. I think psychologically, because I felt somebody was listening, somebody was out there that was, you know, worried about my case. That really helped. Thinking that I was on a path to hopefully identifying something that was wrong. So that was back to see her after 3 or 4 months, and she put me on the FODMAP diet.
Okay, the low FODMAP diet, that's a diet that's used for irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah.
And it's actually now on the NICE guidelines for irritable bowel syndrome. Yeah. And so for people with functional symptoms, you know, the wind and the bloating and the urgency and things, of course it would make logical sense to put you on that. Now the interesting thing about the FODMAP diet, of course, is you're taking out foods that ferment in the gut and can cause the symptoms very similar to what you had. And one of the foods that ferments in the gut is wheat. So it comes out of the diet on a FODMAP diet. You take out wheat, barley and rye, not because of the gluten, but purely because wheat, barley and rye have fructans in which ferment. So part of the FODMAP diet is the removal of wheat, barley and rye because of the fructans. So you went on this FODMAP diet, which basically took wheat, barley and rye out. And what happened when you went on it?
I started feeling better. Louise noticed it just in my approach to the day-to-day, my approach to dinners, looking forward to food, you know, looking forward to eating
something.
So
your appetite started to come back.
Appetite was coming back. We developed, I suppose not that early on, but developed, you know, quite a nice variety of foods you can eat. And actually the guidance available is really useful, you know, to have a look at. So the FODMAP diet made a massive improvement.
So what happened when you're on the FODMAP diet, what happened to your rash?
My rash started fading away, and my...
Joint pain?
Joint pain disappeared.
Now, that's interesting. Now, so your joint pain just went?
It was the joint pain that was really noticeable. Yeah. You know, my hands just...
Suddenly
were
didn't...
fine. And I'm sitting and talking to you with my elbows on the on the edge of the chair, you know, rash disappeared. And I just thought this was fantastic. You know, so it really helped the FODMAP diet. It was a brilliant diet to be on.
And you said you were about 60 to 70% better on the FODMAP diet. So there were obviously still issues. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you said you were still getting loose-ish stools. You're still having sort of Bristol stool scale 5 to 7, still a bit erratic, but you had more control. They were still urgent.
Yeah, because when I was on the FODMAP diet, you can have oats on the FODMAP diet. My life revolved around oats, so I could get energy from oats. And on the FODMAP diet, you don't need to buy the gluten-free oats. So I was living on oats. You know, they were in flapjacks, in granola that we'd make at home, all of that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I went on the gluten-free oats that I really saw my energy levels come up properly and things get that little bit better, make the difference between 60 to 70% and 80 or 90%.
And that's interesting because if you think about the amount of exposure to wheat that you're getting with ordinary oats is so minuscule.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about cross-contamination in the processing at the mill where the oats are getting cross-contaminated with wheat flour. But we're talking about small amounts. We're not talking about you eating a cake. Yeah. We're talking about the tiny amounts that appear on the oats. And that, I think, is really important to remember, that that is enough for celiacs to really respond. So when you came to see me, we knew that you were going the right direction.
Yeah.
And the question then was to look more back at that history as childhood and as a teenager. But the really important thing, which, correct me if I'm wrong, had anybody asked you about your family history at this point?
So my father is a great lover of cakes, and the poor man retired at the age of 60 and within 2 years was diagnosed celiac.
Oh, bless him.
Poor dad's gone through all sorts of issues since he's retired, but celiac disease was the icing on the cake, so to speak. And so dad was diagnosed celiac, which really helped. But I remember for years, and I've said to mum since, you know, dad's rash on his elbows, had a terrible rash on his elbows. For years he did. You know, it used to come and go and flare up. And, you know, I remember him rubbing cortisone cream. And
so
all
long before his diagnosis.
Oh, long before it, yeah. And dad always suffered with kind of bowel issues, you know, and he was either constipated or he was on the run, the runs as he calls them. You know, and he was on and off, but never kind of put his finger on it. And so then he had the blood test. So dad was diagnosed celiac. So this is the male side of the family. Now, in the last 10 or 15 years, his brother has been diagnosed celiac. Noel, his brother, went for a blood test. That came back negative and then went in for a biopsy and was diagnosed on the back of that.
So he was negative at blood test and had to go for a biopsy because the symptoms were just so clear. So somebody obviously was, you know, switched on enough to go, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense, and send him for a biopsy.
Yeah.
And at which point he came back positive.
He was diagnosed.
Okay. How old was he then?
Noel, dad was diagnosed around 62, I think, and Noel must have been diagnosed when he was 65, 66.
Okay.
You know, my father is now 78, so that's quite a while ago. Noel is very good at managing his celiac diet, my father less so. You know, dad's parents, that side of the family, there's a lot of celiacs in that side of the family. There's a couple of female celiacs on that side as well, but it's very strong in that in that side of the family. And the irony is that they were bakers as well.
Were
bakers years ago.
They must have been ill constantly.
Yes, I would think so. But, you know, it's very, very strong in that side of the family.
So the when do you remember whether you were blood tested at all at any point for celiac disease?
I was. So it was during the FODMAP session, I think, I was blood tested for it.
And, of course, you can't be blood tested for celiac disease when you're already taking gluten out of your diet. You have to be eating gluten, you know, every day for at least 2 to 6 weeks, really 6 weeks, to make sure you get a proper result. So you went along and had a blood test, You've got a history in the family of seronegative blood tests. You know, in other words, that they've got celiac disease, but it's not coming up on the blood test. Yeah. Plus, you were then blood tested when you were already on a gluten-free diet.
Yeah.
And I think that's something really important for the health professionals to remember, is that people must be eating gluten. There's absolutely no point whatsoever in testing them or even biopsying them if they're on a gluten-free diet.
Well, I think that's what happened with my biopsy as well, because I was on a complete celiac diet. That's where my conversations with you got me, was testing the celiac behaviour, I suppose, of my system, where I got to the point, I was getting better on the FODMAP, but actually until I sorted the cross-contamination out down to the different butter dishes in the fridge at home, different breadboards for making toast, different toaster, all of that stuff we tested, and that's what made the difference. Mm. That's what got me to where I am now, I think. Mm. You know, it made a massive difference.
And how much better do you feel now compared with how you felt 3 years ago?
Oh, unbelievably so. You know, 100% better. Mm. I'm back, you know, I feel 10 years younger. And I'm not just saying that. You know, I've got energy, I've got a passion for life. I still need to be careful. I think people forget how much trauma your stomach goes through. And my guts went through an awful lot of trauma, and I think they're possibly still recovering. I don't know.
It can take, you know, 2 years for your guts to really heal properly. Yeah. So now, with a very strict celiac diet, how long have you been on it?
18 months, nearly 2 years, I think.
Okay.
And we're getting there. We are really getting there.
But you're probably still going to be prone to functional symptoms.
Yeah, and I am, and I think this FODMAP diet was amazing because it educated me on what I react to, what I don't react to, and I have had to put elements of the FODMAP diet into my day-to-day and marry that with the celiac diet so that my guts can cope. And I've been left with a hangover of not being able to eat much in the onion family. Mm. You know, can't put onions in cooking, leeks, anything like that, garlic, I'm really sensitive to. So I need to be quite careful with that. And, you know, onions are really complex to digest and I just can't do it at the moment. Mm. Maybe that would get better in time and I get better at that, but I just can't do it.
I think it often does, in my experience, I mean, this is anecdotal, obviously, just based on the patients I've seen, is that slowly over time, you might never be able to sit down and have onion soup. Yeah. That would be asking a lot of any of us, actually. And at the end of the day, FODMAP patients have symptoms, gut symptoms, almost identical to you, but what they don't have is the other things. So tell me, what's the rash like now? The rash is gone. You've not had any episodes of the rash at all. So no coccyx itching, no elbow itching.
Lou used to call me a bear because my skin was alive. It was just itchy all the time.
This is before you were on the celiac diet.
Yeah, and while I was on the FODMAP diet, I still had itchy skin, but not as bad. But it was almost hot with wanting to be scratched all the time. Mm. And to the point of making myself bleed. And I was always scratching my back on the door frame at home or something like that. Or just sit in front of Louise and she'd scratch my back. Mm. And I'd want it to be proper scratching. Mm. And nothing would calm it down. Mm. Nothing would calm the itch. And that would disturb your sleep. But that's all gone now.
So you don't get that at all?
Don't get it, no.
And what about the arthritis symptoms?
Gone.
So none, all no gone. Hand problems at all?
Strength, I've got 100% strength back in my hand. You know, and I couldn't use. And as you know, as a tree climber, you have to be able to grip ropes. I had to stop tree climbing. And I just thought, this is it. You know, I'm in my 40s. This is what happens.
And you were doing triathlons before, weren't you?
Yeah.
And you had to stop those.
Stopped all of that.
And what about, are you back to running?
I'm back running. You know, I went out last night. I had a lovely run last night in the dark around the estate. And I did 12 kilometres and really enjoyed it.
And would you have been able to do that a year ago?
No chance. Not at all.
That's amazing. And what about the walking through treacle feeling?
That's gone. You know, it's... I am a different person. You know, it has transformed my life. Going through, I know it took ages, the diagnosis, but actually knowing where I am now, it has turned my life around again.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. I'm really, really grateful to you. I think absolutely fantastic recounting of your experience, and I really hope people learn from it, and I'm very grateful.
I hope it helps people, because it's important.
Mm. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So I have to say a huge thank you to Alan for being so down to earth and honest about his experiences right the way from childhood. And when I look at what we've really learned from this case, I think there are several things we've learned. Really, really look at the early history of the patient. There were already signs when he was a young child and a teenager. But probably the most important aspect is to look at that family history. For him, it was a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, almost every male member on one side of the family, going back several generations, was celiac. And then, of course, there's looking at the fact that actually, for each patient, there may be a case for doing two different diets. In Alan's case, he discovered the FODMAP diet through the dietitian that helped him. And that actually got him sort of 60, 70% better because that diet happens to take out wheat, barley and rye. But we need to remember that also a lot of these patients have functional symptoms as well, IBS type symptoms on top of that. So in fact, he runs the celiac diet alongside the FODMAP diet pretty constantly. And it may be that with time, he becomes more tolerant to some of the FODMAP foods. Obviously, he's never going to be able to reintroduce the gluten foods. And I also really took from what he said about the fact that symptoms can be different in different celiacs. You know, his father's symptoms were very different to his uncle's symptoms. He could have almost no gluten without having a major reaction, whereas his father could get away with a certain amount and not see a huge reaction at all. And there's also that genetic history. Both of those men were diagnosed late in life. And I think we need to remember that, that a lot of celiacs are now being picked up later in life. And also that his uncle had negative bloods. Now, that's really important because I often see patients who have negative bloods but appear to have all the symptoms of celiac disease. And we don't know for sure why that is. We know that in some cases there's an IgA deficiency, but that's not always the case. So it's really important that we don't just disregard a patient's symptoms purely because their blood tests were negative. Anyway, again, thank you very much to Alan, and thank you everybody for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed this podcast and will listen to any future ones that we produce. Thank you. Goodbye. That was the first in the Clinical Cases podcast series. If you have a patient who you feel would be a good learning example for healthcare professionals, then please do email us on patient.podcasts@nhs.net. That's patient.podcasts@nhs.net. We look forward to hearing from you.